My name is Ashley, and this is Let's Talk Dispatch.
I do. You're gonna do it. Do it really well.
And I believe the world needs more dispatchers.
Around in the mud, blood, and beer.
Years that I'm not working 4th of July. 4th of July.
Hey, community policing, right? What about community dispatching?
So on this show, with the help of my guests, we will educate, empower, and support the heroes behind the headset. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode here on Let's Talk Dispatch with me, Ashley, the Raspy Dispatcher. Super excited to join you guys for another episode. You know, time is flying. I mean, it's already almost March. We're going to be going to Cal Nina next month. I'll be doing my first ever live session in person. So, you know, a lot of exciting things coming over the next couple weeks. But it's just crazy how much time flies. We were just celebrating bringing in the new year, and I swear it feels like it's already June. So I hope you guys are enjoying your time so far, and hopefully I'll get to see you at Cal Nina. If you do come out to Cal Nina, we're going to have a booth. Like I said, I'm going to give a session, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So hopefully see you in LA next month. My guest today has over 32 years of experience in public safety and is registered public safety leader. We know this often as RPL, and they have over 19 years of experience as an instructor with APCO. They have a long career with a lot of interesting accomplishments along the way. My guest today, Jeremy. Hey, Jeremy.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I am doing good. Wish you would warm up a little bit. You know, I don't mind winter. I just would rather have a lot of white stuff. So it's just been cold and dry.
Oh my gosh. It's been rainy here in California. We've been like on flood watch for 488 hours. So I could use a little more warmth as well. So I feel you on that.
Yeah. I hear you guys have got a lake that has reformed after a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, that sounds about right. We are definitely filling up our storage here. So, Jeremy, tell us a little bit about how you got into public safety.
I got into public safety back in, I want to say, 91, maybe 92. Massachusetts just recently became a post state. But before that, they had a part-time police academy. It was called the Reserve Intermittent Police Academy. My uncle was the captain in charge of training for the sheriff's department for the county I lived in, and asked if I wanted to go to the part-time academy. And that really was what got me into public safety. So I worked as a part-time deputy, part-time police officer in Massachusetts. I was also a call force firefighter and EMT, and decided in 2000, yeah, about 2000, with no luck at getting into any of those full time, that I was going to make public safety communications my career. And started in probably 2001, part-time, and then just my career has grown since then to my last position within a municipal or government department, Albany, New York, which I left in October. Yeah, so that's kind of a quick synopsis of it. I've done a lot since, 92, the Olympics, Salt Lake City in 2002. I was one of 35 dispatchers that volunteered to go out there. I also was liaison person between us and Utah Olympic Public Safety Command. In 2004 and 5, the military asked me to come over to Kuwait and set up the Fire and Emergency Services Communications Center for the military bases over in Kuwait. That was a contract position, did that for 2 years. I've done a lot of other things. I ran a program at a college in Enfield, Connecticut. It was a semester-long course where people became certified to become dispatchers. So it met and exceeded any standard that is out there as far as subjects and certifications. I did that for 5 or 6 years. Moved back up to Massachusetts. Was a dispatch administrator, which is the college's term for a dispatch manager for college police department. They didn't have civilian dispatchers, so I created that program and stuff. And then in 2021, I took the job in Albany.
That's awesome. I mean, so you've done so many things. What was it like for you in the beginning?
Like a lot of people that started in the 90s, 2000s, and you know, even in some cases now, it's here is the microphone, here's the phone, here's the computer. not even really training on the state's version of CJIS, which is actually LEAPS or CJIS. It was take this security test that we all have to do every 2 years, and here's a giant three-ring boulder folder with everything you need to know. There was no real on-the-job training. There was no certification. Most of my career, my certifications were done out of my own pocket and on my own time. My uncle, again, you know, running the training department for the sheriff's department, we always talked about what we now call best practices, but, you know, the importance of training, not just for police officers or deputies, firefighters, EMTs, correctional officers, but also for us. And that is really what motivated me when I did start to teach in 2004, 2005. You know, to teach current best practices, you know, to train dispatchers to be the best they can. I've never expected any of them to ever know everything, but know where to look. And I tell them, when I taught the academy, as I called it, in Enfield at the college, at the academy that I ran in Albany, for the dispatchers, you know, you don't need to know everything. You just need to know, if you don't know, where to get the information.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people who don't work in law enforcement, public safety, don't have an understanding of just how far we've come in such little time. I mean, we just vendored for the Denise Amber Lee Foundation's conference, Be the Difference, who is a foundation that is, you know, created from a tragic story. If you're listening and you're not familiar with it, I definitely suggest looking into that story. Nathan does a really good job at, you know, telling the story of his wife, who was a victim of a stranger abduction, and just kind of how all these situations between different agencies helped to create the ending that happened. And so that organization came together to help push standard practice, best practice training for dispatchers, because as you've mentioned in your experience, like, it wasn't a thing. In the beginning, it was just kind of like, here's what you need to do. You'll figure it out. Like, it was very not geared toward training the dispatcher the way we see it today. Before we continue, we wanted to take a moment to thank our partners at Prepared. You can learn more about the awesome support and technology Prepared provides to first responders by heading to prepared911.com. Partners like Prepared help to continue our mission of supporting, empowering, and educating the heroes under the headset. You can learn more about our resources and partnerships by heading to theraspydispatcher.com. Now let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of meeting Nathan Lee on a couple occasions, and we've talked at length about that. You know, I have always told people that if you walk away from hearing his wife's story and his story and don't realize that we as a profession need to do better, need to be better, you need to exit the career because it's that important.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I mean, when you think back to like how your career started and like handling calls, do you remember any of your early calls or like how that felt when you first started, you know, they actually let you answer the calls?
A couple I remember. There were two that were, well, three that were life-changing. Mm-hmm. The first one was my first full-time job. The chief for that department I knew when he was a sergeant and patrolman in my hometown. Mm-hmm. And again, no training, you know. And I took a call from a woman who I took it as her son was just not listening to her. He was being belligerent or whatever. And that's what I dispatched it out to. What it wound up being is that he was not responsive.
Oh, wow.
He was unconscious for whatever reason. And, you know, that bothered me. You know, I beat up myself a lot about it. I actually turned in my resignation, and the chief called me up to his office and he said, no, I'm not accepting it. You know, you made a mistake, you realized it, you know, no. And I appreciate him doing that because that probably would have been the end of my public safety career. Mm. Another one was I was working for the largest city in Western Mass. And I took a call overnight on Easter. So, you know, into Easter morning, a lady called up 911, explained that her and her husband brought home her preschool, as far as like before kindergarten, daughter from the hospital to pass. Mm-hmm. So my first question is, because I had experience with hospice, is hospice involved? And she said, no, the hospital said because of Easter, they weren't open. I wanted to literally kill somebody at that time, because what that hospital did was create a situation that the husband and wife did not have to go through. It was the only time I put a 911 call on hold. I called down to my captain. I said, I know what your answer is going to be, but I need to ask. And I explained to him the story. And he's like, you know, Jeremy, I empathize, I understand, but because hospice was not involved, we have to take it as, you know, a regular death. So I got back on the phone with her and explained to her that basically the entire city was about to drop down onto her house. Mm. As far as police, fire, EMS, detectives, all that. And I explained why. What was hard was she was more empathetic towards my situation and my having to have to put her through that and her husband than anything else. I did mention to her, hoping that, you know, not at that moment, but maybe a month or two or three later, it would click that, you know, the hospice lied to her, that hospice is open 24/7 and they shouldn't have did what they did. I don't know if she ever, you know, did anything about it, but that was gut-wrenching. It's hard enough to have a 4 or 5 year old, you know, pass you know, even though you know it's coming, but then mm-hmm. to have all this, and I know, you know, the department probably, you know, grilled her and her husband, you know, because they're considered suspects until, you know, I get all that. I've been out in the field. I get that. And that's what really bothered me. And then the third wasn't really a hard call. It was just a lot to juggle. I was in Kuwait. We were just one dispatcher per shift. So I was a manager and working at the same time. We're down in southern Kuwait, maybe 45 minutes north of the Saudi border. But right at the northern Iraq border was a camp that used to be a UN camp and then a US camp. And I got a call from them saying, you know, we got an MP that was shot right off base on a border. So, you know, here I am, I have to step and I have to activate, you know, the Kuwaiti military, our fire EMS crew up at Navstar, that base, and do it all. You know, I'm thankful that by the time I finished making all those calls, that MP was back on that base and getting helicoptered into Camp Airstrom, which is where we are, which is where the Navy hospital was. But that was just a lot to juggle because you're basically activating all of Kuwait.
Yeah.
And then turning around and you know telling them, you know, we're all set. You know, they still had to do their investigation as far as who shot and all that. But that was probably the craziest call because it was just me.
Yeah.
But none of the calls, I never had the opportunity, even though I knew about critical incident stress management and have known it since I was a call force firefighter, wasn't afforded the opportunity. Or even knew how to contact them myself to say, hey, I'd like to talk to somebody. So,
and that's so unfortunate.
Yeah, that's what it's difficult.
I think that we're definitely getting better at acknowledging that folks need to vent, need to talk about the heavy stuff we're carrying around with us, especially that we pick up from just doing our job, you know? So how important do you think crisis intervention and peer support is in this field?
Yeah. Crisis intervention is critical because that's where we as dispatchers, just like police officers who go through a CIT week-long course, and we as dispatchers have the ability to go through either an 8 or a 16-hour course, learn about the options that are out there for mental health for the callers. Mm-hmm. You know, what resources are available locally, but then also how to handle these calls with the best practices, how to de-escalate a caller, which we can use not just for somebody who's in mental health crisis, but anybody who we just can't control the call. It's teaching us how to control the call. Teaching us, you know, not to say calm down. It's actual meat and potato of how can you, you know, get the person to focus on you and the information and to help them either get out of crisis or keep them status quo until professionals help. Very, very critical. I've been teaching that. I haven't taught it since I've been in New York, but before that, for about 3 years, I taught it in Massachusetts as part of one of the mental health nonprofits. Critical incident stress management, peer support, debriefing, defusing, all of that is critical because that is about our mental health. It is about our well-being. You know, it needs to be more widely accepted and understood that dispatchers either need to partake in it with whatever departments they're associated with or by themselves. You know, and it's not about the tactics. It's not about the operational procedures. It's about how are you handling this traumatic event? And, you know, getting people to talk about it, because that helps them to put it in their memory banks in a healthy way that will help lessen the chance for post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not mandatory, but it's important. And every time we do a debriefing, defusing, or even a peer-to-peer, there's a whole bunch of educational material that we give them. Debriefings and defusings are done with clinicians there. So they're peer-supported, clinician, kind of, I don't want to say supervised, but kind of backed up by clinicians. So all of us are dispatchers, firefighters, EMTs, correctional officers, police officers. You know, none of us are associated with the department that's requesting it. These things, including the peer-to-peer, should not be done at a police department, fire department, fire station, or anything like that. Library, senior center, you know, away from the action. Nothing's recorded. There's no rank. I've even known debriefings that have politely asked command staff to, you know, exit, that, you know, they're politely not welcomed.
No.
You know, because it's not about them. It is about how are the people doing emotionally, mentally, psychologically, with the events. It's critically important. Our PTSD numbers are almost identical to those in the field. And my feeling that the only reason why it's slightly less, maybe by 5%, is because the studies for dispatchers is only maybe 8-10 years in the making, where in the other field has been going on for a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
But recent studies has us at anywhere from 18 to 24% of us experience PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is because they're not provided these services. You know, the employee assistance programs, you know, they don't know the uniqueness of public safety. You know, they will very easily misinterpret a dark, sick sense of humor that we have for probably something else, because they don't get that when they're dealing with accountants or office people, or, you know, so it's important to have it. You know, I also like, you know, peer-to-peer, you know, where you see somebody who might be having struggles, personal, work, whatever, and the culture, you know, says, okay, you can go to your boss and let them know that person A is having struggles for the sole reason of getting them help. That's it. Again, no record of it, no smudge mark on your record. It's all about getting them the help that they need. Vermont State Police does a great job. Everybody from a part-time janitor up to the colonel, they all are peer trained for this type of stuff. And their culture is set up where, you know, it's not going to affect anything except get them the help that they need.
And I think that's key, right? It's creating an environment where people feel like they can reach out for help, that they can seek services through their departments. You know, like you said, with the, you know, the debriefings and things, like no recording, no, you know, fall back for having the conversation about things you think went wrong, things that could have went better, is key to creating that environment where people can work through the stuff that happens. Because even in your experience with the call that you shared with us, it's like, we're going to make mistakes. We're humans. doing this job are going to make mistakes, and what are our departments doing to support us through those mistakes so we don't make them again, but also so we don't fear making mistakes that cause more mistakes to happen out of fear, you know?
Right. Yeah. I've had an employee come to me with a shift supervisor, basically accusing another employee of possibly taking something of theirs. So, you know, we all met and stuff, and you know, my hair on the back of my neck rose. There's something else going on. So after that was all resolved, I met with this, you know, person. I said, hey, you know, how are you? You know, and we got to the meat and potatoes. You know, every department that I've worked for since I've been a peer knows that they can come to me. I will take off my supervisor hat and, you know, work with them as a peer. And that's exactly what I did with this individual. And I said, look, you know, don't have to talk to me. You know, I know you don't want to talk to any a buddy in the department, and I totally respect that and get that. I said, give me 24 hours. Let me find somebody, because in New York, they don't have a network of critical incident stress management teams like my home state of Massachusetts does. So I had to find, you know, somebody that, you know, would reach out either through Zoom or whatever. And I did. And I gave this person that information. And I said, here you go, you know. I checked in with them a week or so later just to see if, you know, he was able to talk to that person, and he did. And then, you know, how are you? And I left it at that, because my job was to guide him to somebody that could help him. And I did that job. You know, I've also been in departments, and this really shows, even though it's newer command staff and people who are my age, maybe a slightly younger, still are in the dark about us. We were looking at, and they have since opened up a new center. And I recommended a small, probably like 10 by 10, maybe smaller room, quiet room, you know, where people who might have had a rough call or whatever just need to go and decompress for a couple minutes. I said, all I need is three walls, a door, a couple of outlets, HVAC piped into it. I said, I will take care of getting all the furniture, paint, everything. And I was going to work with a couple of companies, you know, from our area and from the Northeast, to supply all that stuff. And, you know, I told the command staff at the time, if you need data, you need numbers or whatever to justify this, you know, just let me know and I'll send it to you. And, you know, they decided not to do it. And their excuse was that, well, you never sent us any data, number, blah, blah, blah. You know, so of course, part of me wants to, but I was like, you know, but I didn't respond negatively, whatever. But I'm sitting there thinking, I told you when you were ready for it, just to let me know, and I would send it to you. But I was like, so, you know, and their response was, well, if they need a quiet room, then, you know, they need much more help than what a quiet room can offer. It's like, wrong.
Yeah.
Wrong. So yeah. Wrong. Shows how little you know about critical incident stress management, peer-to-peer, debriefing, all that well-being. Yeah. It shows just how in the dark you are about this, you know. You know, and I was disappointed, because that is something that would be used, hopefully not regularly, but would be used.
Heck yeah. Even just
it would have cost
15 minutes. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, and it wouldn't have cost them anything more, really, because they were building this space out. So what's, you know, 2-3 walls, depending on where they put it, in a door.
Yeah.
You know, it was heartbreaking because, mm-hmm. you know, I want all my people, I want all dispatchers, I want all people in public safety to retire, you know, and enjoy retirement, not just be dead in, you know, 5-7 years, which is the average in public safety, because of all the stressors that we have in our career. So that was heartbreaking.
And I think it also just speaks to how, you know, our cultures and our centers surrounding, especially this topic, really does come from the top down. You know, if our admin, if our supervisors, if folks who are tasked with debriefing don't acknowledge the realities of what we're going through and the need for tools, you know, and the tools don't always have to be these huge things, you know, like if you're going to seek therapy, right. You don't have to go 5 times a week, you know, it can just be something as simple as a quiet room that you sit in once a shift.
Yep.
You know, the idea is to be preventative. And then when something big does happen, you've already done all the work. You can manage it a little bit and then get more help when you need more help, you know? So it's very preventative. Yeah. It's not going to solve the problem.
Yeah. And it doesn't cost anything either. Mm-hmm. In my last job, I took all the handouts that we give out in the 2 CISM teams that I'm on. So I put them in the break room. So there's a little, you know, privacy if you decide to get it, but they're all on the wall with those like plexiglass clear like racks to hold magazines. Each one is color coded folder with the label on it. And it's, you know, about signs and symptoms of stress, you know, stuff you should know pre bad event and post bad event, all the way down to the last one was double sided, printed in fluorescent orange flyer that talks about this is what your family and friends should know. And, you know, I recommend that just put it on your refrigerator, put it on your counter, just have it there. So when you do have a bad day, whether it's a major catastrophe or just a bad day, the people in your life know. You know, so, you know, even stuff like that with a quiet room, you know, well-being. You know, talking about well-being, whether it's heart health, stress management, you know, everything that includes our mental health well-being is important. Mm. You know, I'm even a firm believer that I would love to see departments when somebody says, okay, I'm putting in my retirement paper, they make it part of the retirement process where they go through some kind of something, training, if you want to call it that, on what to expect once you retire. Because there's so much unknown. You know, we're going from, you know, Mach 1 to hitting a brick wall with retirement. Yeah. And, you know, that's a big stressor and stuff like that. I know a couple of departments that do that. They tell the people they have to go through like a 4-hour, and it's just, you know, basic stuff. You know, do you have your finances in place? They're not asking to see it. They're just educating you on what to be prepared for and what to expect, because you go from working most definitely 48 or more hours a week to not working at all. You know,
yeah. I mean, it's a hard shift, I imagine. I feel like a lot of people talk about it even when they just switch jobs out of dispatch. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been living in this world for X amount of years, and then they do a shift. And some folks have a hard time, you know, turning that off, because it's definitely a certain level of it's a different world that we operate in, you know, doing what we do daily. To go back to the regular civilian world, where you're just working a 9-to-5 and the phone rings and, you know, it's not something traumatic happening. That's hard. It's hard for people to switch, you know? And I think what we're talking about here is just departments giving their people tools and the people finding the tools for themselves as well. Cause learning how to protect yourself in retirement is just another tool to add to your tool belt, right? It's just more knowledge, it's more information, and all those things are just going to make living our lives easier.
Yeah. One of the things I'm doing in my semi-retirement is I'm going back and teaching in-service courses, which I haven't done since being in Albany because I had to focus on everything there. And a lot of what I'm going to be teaching is, you know, sections on crisis intervention, like, you know, verbal de-escalation, and, you know, how to handle calls, how to control calls beyond saying calm down, because we all know that never works in any situation anywhere in the universe. You know, to mental health first aid for dispatchers. You know, I'm going to be teaching a lot of this throughout Massachusetts. I'm hoping to, you know, maybe you know, sync with one of the training companies that does national, the ones that I'm working with, which is what I've worked with before, does just Massachusetts. You know, I would like to be able to get, you know, out there beyond that and get this information out there. The good thing is the company that I am working with, we will also be doing, you know, training online, live training and stuff. So technically you don't have to be in Massachusetts. It's not going to necessarily be Massachusetts specific, you know, so, and I will advertise that stuff like I do with other things on different social media platforms when that comes up. But I want to get this information out there, you know, to provide the best possible service to the callers, to our people out on the street, and to our fellow dispatchers. It's just so vital.
You know, the more information, the better. I mean, especially when we're talking about our mental health or our callers' mental health. I mean, the reality is that is a big number of the calls we're receiving, you know, into our centers is dealing with folks' mental health struggles, from the simplest of just them recognizing they need help to the extreme where they're in a state of wanting to unalive themselves or threatening to harm someone else, so on and so forth. So having more information that equips us to deal with those type of calls and in turn check our mental health, you know, in our own personal lives and manage our own stress is only going to extend our careers, you know, make us be able to continue to do the job for as long as we wish to do it for.
Right. And it's hard enough, you know, you know, aging in our specific area of public safety is hard because technology, the amount of technology, you know, and needing to invest in yourself to maintain those skills. You know, we're all going to be looking at video to 911 shortly. You know, I was when I first heard that that's what was going to be coming down the pipe with next gen 911, I was like, I'm going to retire when that happens. because I'm thinking, great, we're going to be witnessing this stuff firsthand. I now know through some of the next gen 911 telephone system companies out there that, you know, we have the option, or we will have the option of not seeing. It will still be recorded. It will be attached to the call or to the RMS incident and stuff like that, but we don't see it. They will never see us, you know, which were two other things that I was outright terrified. You know, I have seen stuff both out on the streets here and in Kuwait. You know, it has a definite permanent effect on us. I would not want a dispatcher to be sitting here like you and I are and see something like that happen live right in front of them when they're trying to help this person. I know I would just, I would just crack and crawl, you know, so, you know, I'm glad that that's not going to be the case, but, you know, again, it's still going to be an additional stressor. It's going to be another thing that, you know, impacts our mental health, and we need to be ahead of that.
Yeah, and I think one thing, you know, I'm a big fan of technology and adding technology to this job, to our centers, and I think one thing that, you know, companies like the one we're partnered with, Prepared, they're doing a really good job at acknowledging our fears and reassuring, reassuring that they hear that and they're making fixes to be able to bring the technology in and still protect the dispatchers, especially when we talk about, you know, video calling and 911. As you mentioned, a lot of these services are, it's a one-way thing where they're not looking at us, the dispatcher. And two, the dispatcher is initiating it, you know, because it's useful in some way, shape, or form for the call. You know, noise complaint, probably don't care to hear the noise you're hearing. We believe you, we're going to come out for it. But a medical call or something like that, it could be really beneficial. But definitely giving dispatchers choice in situations where they can have the choice, you know, is vital to integrating these people.
I've worked with you know, Prepared, you know, I've worked with a couple of their people. You know, it's a great resource. It's a great you know, to have access to something like that, just like Rapid SOS or any of these, you know, vendors that can help us help the people that we're supposed to be there for. You know, you know, technology that allows breadcrumbs for you know, mobile callers. So you know, not only do we know where they are, but we know, you know, how they got from when they started calling us to when we got a first responder there, if that information is needed. Geofencing, you know, all these apps that are used on large colleges, or really any college, or, you know, large campuses, period, whether it's education or not, where you can say, you know, look, stay away from this building, either because we're re-roofing it, you know, or because we have an active shooter there. You know, all these things are, you know, just incredible. You know, I've liked them. They're easy. You know, and I've worked in centers where I've done it. I've had to do it all. You know, I've been the station officer, the dispatcher, the call taker, doing EMD, and needing to access these apps to departments like my last one, where you're either working as a call taker one day, or a police dispatcher, or a fire dispatcher. You know, I've been in, you know, both sides of it, and these tools are just so helpful.
Yeah, they're definitely helpful, and I definitely appreciate when companies take feedback positively and make changes. I mean, I've definitely been in situations where I'm utilizing a system and it's a struggle because, like you said, and something I think people don't realize is sometimes you're the only person in there, maybe you and one other person, and you're fielding all these calls, and maybe you have an active shooter situation and you're trying to get out a notification to everybody who's not calling in to let them know what's going on. And you have to be able to manage that system, which isn't always user-friendly, while still doing the rest of your jobs. You know, like these things don't stop in order for you to do this. And that sometimes falls through the cracks with people having an understanding of why things went slower maybe than they would have liked to happen in regards to like high priority situations. And the reality is we're only as successful as the tools we have, like how user-friendly these tools are. So the more integrated we can be, the more user-friendly these things are, it really makes a difference in those high priority situations.
Definitely. Yep.
Yeah. I did want to ask you about, you mentioned it earlier, and I think it's so cool about your experience with dispatching at the Olympics. Like, how does one fall into that? Yeah. And how does one get involved? Like, that's so cool.
Yeah, that was a MySpace back in the day, back in 2001. You know, somebody posted somewhere that the Utah Olympic Public Safety Command were looking for dispatchers to help supplement. They had more than that. They had thousands of volunteer police officers, medics, not only from the U.S. but Canada, as far as medics. Every single federal agency that has any type of law enforcement entity had a presence at these games. So this was on a MySpace group, just like our Facebook groups. And I figured, you know, this is a kind of like a once in a lifetime, maybe twice.
Heck yeah.
You know, so I, you know, got the information. You know, I was relatively new. You know, it's 2002. I, you know, haven't been dispatching full time for that long. They took me along with 34 other people. And then they placed us really based on our specialties. So there were some people who had a lot of experience and training as tactical dispatchers. So they worked with sniper teams. They were up on top of the buildings. They were in the woods with the sniper teams as their communication link. Other people worked various venues, you know, or worked at the actual PSAPs within that government just as an extra hand. My job was I worked for the State Department, you know, doing the communications and CJIS stuff for their agents out on the road, on top of being, you know, the liaison officer while I was there. So, like, we had one gentleman who thankfully was just stoned but thought he had a heart attack, went to the hospital. So, you know, my job was go check on him, communicate with his, you know, wife, you know, a whole bunch of different stuff like that during the games. It was volunteer. They provided housing and food. You had to pay for your own flight out there. But what a great experience. You know, this was before NIMS. But, you know, every USAR team, Ares team, you know, all those teams were out there. A lot of them were based. Operations were at the National Guard base that I lived at while I was there. So I got to interact with a lot of them. My real first massive exposure to Incident Command System. You know, I got to go to different events. I got to see Sheryl Crow at a medal ceremony. I went to curling and got addicted to curling because that was the first year that it was at the Olympics. You know, I went to the opening ceremonies. I went to some cross-country skiing. Which actually bumped into a friend of mine who used to be in my first department I worked at as a dispatcher, who then left and worked for Secret Service, and he was there doing his Secret Service stuff. So I bumped into him, didn't even realize he was there.
Because it was a secret.
Yeah, exactly. But it was great. You know, we did a, and I forgot the name of what it's called, but you know, after you do an event, you kind of just, you know, how did the dispatchers perform? Where did we, you know, where do things need to be improved next time? After action report. So a lot of us were involved in the after action report. I would love to go out to LA. You know, I don't know if LA will have the need, you know. Several months after 9/11 is significantly different than 20 some odd, 30 some odd years, whatever it is later. LA, you know, in California itself has a lot more resources than Utah. And now the Utah games were spread out over the space that is almost equivalent to the state of Connecticut. So that was a lot. You know, very spread out. You know, I'm on the 2028 LA games site. You know, I would love to go out there. You know, preferably in a paid position, doing kind of like what I did at Salt Lake. I think that'd be kind of a cool way to cap off a career. You know, but I don't know what they're doing. They don't even have like a public safety component. At least officially announced yet. You know, if it is something that they do, and I am aware of it, I will be posting it. So if opportunities are there, people can volunteer for it. Same reason why I did Kuwait. You know, it's a once in a lifetime thing to be able to, you know, do what I did over there.
You know. And I think it just kind of speaks to, like, a lot of times people are like, well, what can I do as a dispatcher, like, other than work for my local county agency? Like, there are just so many different settings where our skills and our abilities are useful. And when I hear about, you know, like you working for the Winter Games or even going out to Kuwait to do the radio stuff, I mean, these are just things you wouldn't automatically think of. So for people who are considering what's next, maybe need a change of pace, like these are some ideas or avenues where they can look at in like dealing with or sports events in general. We, you know, we have professional teams all over the place that utilize dispatch, and these are options. There are options out there.
Oh, there's so many. Each state has an emergency management agency, a state version of FEMA. They all have a communications unit. And within there, you have your communications leaders, which I'm one in New York, your technicians, or several different categories, you know, that you would be used. So like when there's a big event like the State Fair in New York, they will be asking, you know, us to go out there. There is FEMA itself. There's the USAR teams. There's the DMAT teams. All these teams have a communications component to it because of ICS. You know, there is opportunities working at military bases, federal agencies, the South Pole, McMurdo Station. I don't think it's General Dynamics anymore, but at one point General Dynamics was the one who had the contract for the dispatchers and the fire service. You know, so you can do that either for a 1 year or for a half year, either during the winter out down there or summer down there. Contract companies for the military and going over to Kuwait, to the Samoan Islands. You know, I forgot what base it was. It's a very little known base, but it's very tropical. You could go work there. There's so much opportunities out there. Incident dispatch, tactical dispatch. So if you have a department that has a mobile communications vehicle, in Massachusetts, their fire service, the Department of Fire Service, which runs the academy, arson investigation, stuff like that. Massachusetts is broken up into fire districts for them. And they have, I think, two of these huge, bigger than a fire engine apparatus, communications vehicle. And they have people who are full-time dispatchers that are on these teams that when that resource is activated in your fire district, so, Western Mass or the four counties in Western Mass, you would go out in the field to do that. Search and rescue teams, have a need for dispatchers. There's just so many opportunities out there, and for a whole bunch of different reasons, people just don't realize that these types of things are out there either to supplement. So like Albany, they just got rid of their command vehicle and the communications vehicle. They're getting a new one that's going to be combined. But dispatchers that are trained in the incident tactical dispatch, which is done as a FEMA class in person in New York, when there's a big event, the Tulip Fest, which will be coming up, they have that vehicle there and it's manned. So here's a way to, a little bit of overtime, I get to spread my wings a little bit, I get out of the center for a day. There's just so much out there besides, or beyond, I should say, not besides, beyond working at a PSAP.
It's so true. And I mean, as we bring this to a close, and one of the questions that I ask everybody that comes onto the show is, what advice would you give someone who is considering a career as a dispatcher in dispatch?
Learn as much as you can about the job and what it entails. It is more than just answering calls and sending police, fire, and EMS to go to call A, whatever. There's a lot of sites out there that tell you about the, the job, the emotional, the physical, the demands, all that. Learn about that. Mm-hmm. When I interview people, I have a 2 or 3 page checklist that I go through with him, and it's the good, the bad, and the ugly of what you can expect when you're a dispatcher, because I want them to know, is this something I really want or can do? Learn about the department that you're, applying at. Learn as much as you can, not only about how many calls, types of calls, are they one discipline, multidiscipline, but everything. Do they have a good recruitment and retention rate? What do they do besides pay? Everybody says it's always about pay. The reality is it's not. It's like the fourth or fifth thing out there for why somebody either takes a job or keeps the job. Mm-hmm. Learn all this, because I see dispatchers that, are like, I'm leaving. I've been here 3 months. the environment is hostile and toxic from the newest person all the way up to management. Make sure. And I've come across some of those posts, and I tell people, I said, look, I get it. And I'm so sorry that you've had to be exposed to that. My advice is find somewhere, even if it's part-time, if you want to stay into the career, so you can keep your skills current, so you can keep mm-hmm. your certificates current, mm-hmm. and then really investigate, finding a center, and make sure that they're providing not only the training that your state requires, but the in-service training that they're supposed to get. And make sure that they're given that. That's probably the best advice I can give.
I think it's excellent advice. It's so true. You have to do your research as well. You know, one of the things that I always say is like, you're the prize in this process. And if you're not asking questions, trying to figure out if that department is just as good as a fit for you as you are for them, then you're not doing the work, you know, and you need to make right. sure that it is a good fit both ways, yeah. more importantly for you than for them. So yeah. Jeremy, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming out, for sharing your very unique career experience and history. I know you said you're semi-retired now, but I have a feeling you're going to be doing a lot more stuff for the training and advancement of dispatchers. So I'm just going to say thank you in advance as you continue to, you know, help dispatchers out there.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for, you know, having this platform to share everybody's story that wants to share their story and get it out there. It is a great resource. It helps us feel included. And it's important that we're able to share our stories with one another and stuff. Mm-hmm. So thank you for, not only, you know, this, but, you know, you're still working as dispatch.
Yep.
You got a lot on your plate. So thank you for, you know, going above and beyond and realizing the importance of having your, Let's Talk Dispatch podcast. And I've been following you for a while, on social media through your RASB dispatcher. Great stuff. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that as well. It's really my pleasure, and it's so much fun meeting you folks in person and virtually. And I appreciate you being willing to share your story with me and also the rest of the world, because I post it out there. Certainly appreciated.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you again.
Awesome. Well, Jeremy, I'll be right back with you.
Okay.
All right, everybody. That was another amazing episode here at Let's Talk Dispatch. Jeremy, 32 years in public safety, 19 years of being an instructor. Just such an amazing and interesting career, and really a testament to, if you want to do it, you can go out there and do it. Don't be afraid to spread your wings. Try something new. There are so many different avenues where you can take our skills and knowledge and use it out there in the world. Maybe the next Olympic Games. Who knows? So definitely take those leaps. Do that research and find something that speaks to you. Thank you all so much for joining us today. If you're interested in being a guest, head to theraspydispatcher.com. Of course, don't forget to like, subscribe, rate, tell a friend, all the things. Until next time, everybody, stay raspy. Thank you for listening to Let's Talk Dispatch podcast. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're interested in becoming a guest on the show, or maybe even submitting your own story, you can do all that and more at theraspydispatcher.com. Until next time, stay raspy.